Okay, so this is object recognition, lesson number 4, and I will basically explain the most popular technique that we know of to carry out parametric recognition. Most of these techniques are based on the main algorithm, which is based on applying Bayes' rule. That's called Bayesian classification, and all of the rest are some simplification of this basic algorithm. So I will tell you why these other alternatives are different, but how they are based in Bayesian classification anyway. There's a final group of methods which are not based on Bayesian classification that I will briefly mention, and then I'll just draw the conclusions of this lesson. So to start with the introduction, I point out once again that the recognition method that we're going to study is based on global parameters of the objects that we want to recognize. So we will use descriptors as we saw in the other lessons, like area and perimeter, that you can compute if the object is fully visible and isolated from the rest of the objects. That's what we call parametric recognition. It's very simple and very fast. The algorithms are simple and very fast, and in applications where this is the case, then these algorithms are very efficient. We also say that it's less robust because, of course, as I said, the objects have to be fully visible and separate one from the other. So in applications where this can happen, you can't carry out parametric recognition. You have to do what's called geometric recognition. And those algorithms are based on not global properties of the object, but local properties, like the vertices, the edges, corners, circles, geometric information in general, that allows you to identify objects even if they are only partially visible and even if they are overlapping. Okay, we're not going to study these algorithms, but I guess in artificial intelligence you study geometric recognition, right? Okay, so people that study computer science know these algorithms also. We don't have time to study them here, so we will concentrate on recognition based on descriptors or parameters. And the general scheme of the system that we're going to build is composed of two elements. There is a learning phase and then there's an exploitation phase. In the learning phase, basically, what we will do is teach the system which objects it has to recognize. So you basically train the system, showing it images of objects that you identify. So you will say, this is a rectangle, this is a rectangle, this is a rectangle. In the case of the images that we used 5 times, the system then will threshold the image, carry out connectivity analysis, compute the area, perimeter, and other descriptors for the object that you show it. And since you have identified it, then it will store that information in a database saying, so rectangles have this area and have this perimeter and have this descriptors in general. This is what you do in the learning phase for each of the objects that the system should be able to recognize. And then in a second exploitation phase, what you have to, what the system has to do is take an image of the object that it has to recognize, also do thresholding, then connectivity analysis, separate the blobs for each one of them, compute the descriptors, and then look up in the database to decide which of the objects that it already learned is the most, the one that most closely resembles this one. Okay? So, that's the way in which the system is going to work in general. The actual way in which you answer the question, which of the objects in the database is more similar to this one, that's what makes all the techniques that I will explain different. So exactly how you answer that question has to do with the method of or the algorithm of recognition that we're going to use. But all of those systems work essentially using this this general scheme. So just some notation. We're going to assume that we have a class omega of n objects that we know, omega 1 to omega n. The system is going to identify objects based on m descriptors like area, perimeter, the moment, m different ones. And then of each of the objects that you have learned n different samples. In these examples, 5. Okay? So in this example, you would have 3 objects that you know. You have 5 samples of each of the objects. And maybe your system understands the 3 moments, the 3 invariant moments, for example, and also the perimeter. So in that case, m would be 4. So with these definitions, the system answering the question of recognition is basically answering this question. Taking one sample, which is information of an image, taking one sample x of descriptors corresponding to the same object, which class omega I does it correspond to? Is it omega 1? Is it omega 2? Is it omega n? Actually, this system should be able to answer this double question, which is it one of the ones that you know, or is it an unknown object? This is actually not as simple as it sounds to answer, but it's a very important question. The system should be able to also say, I don't know what that object is. Okay? So the question is actually double-fold. Which object does it correspond to, or is it an unknown object that maybe the system would have to learn also? This is so answering this question, the method to answer that question is what we deal with in this lesson on recognition. As I said at the beginning, the basic theory behind parametric recognition is classification according to the Bayes rule. And explained in somewhat simplistic terms, it goes this way. What we're going to do is we're going to consider descriptors as random variables. For example, the area of an object, sometimes you measure it and it's 2000, sometimes it's 2002. Sometimes it's 1954. So if every time you measure it, it's slightly different because of the conditions of measurement and because of the error that the sensor produces. So every descriptor is going to be a random variable. And we're going to model the objects that we know using this conditional probability, which basically says, what is the probability that a certain descriptor has a certain value given that the object is omega sub I? Okay, so what is the typical area for rectangles? What is the typical area for triangles? What is the typical perimeter for circles? That is what we're going to model as a conditional probability distribution. This is also called the likelihood. The likelihood function. And additionally, the system can also have information of the a priori probability of each every class appearing. And this depends on the application. But for example, in simple examples, you could say so a priori probability means without any information, which is the object that is more likely, or how likely is each one of the objects that I know. Okay? So if I were to identify a student in computer vision without seeing actually the student, and the question was, is it a boy or a girl? Without seeing him or her, I would say it's a boy, because there's only one girl in this class of computer vision. So it's more likely that the class is boy. That's a priori, without knowing anything else, without actually seeing the object if you want. That's what I mean by a priori probability. It may be the case that all of the objects are equally probable a priori. So in that case, the probability that each one appears is basically 1 over n. Why? Because in the Bayesian classification, all of the objects considered are each of the possible answers that the system can respond. So that's why the a priori probability of each class has to sum equal to 1. Okay, there's no this system considers no possibility that the object is going to be unknown. So afterwards, we'll have to see what we can do to include unknown objects in this scheme. Okay, in principle, all of the objects are going to be known. If I see an object, I'm supposed to be able to identify it in some way. So if I have the likelihood of each object, if I have the a priori probability for each class, then I'm able to decide based on a certain sample which is the most probable class that actually the sample may come from. And in this simple example, you can see it's just a two case example. It might be omega 1 or it might be omega 2, and I'm only using one descriptor, which is x. It could be the area, for example. And these functions are actually the likelihood of each of the classes for the descriptor x. So that means, in very simple terms, if I'm not considering anything else, that would mean that it's more likely that the class is 1 when the descriptor is up to this value. When it's over this value, then it's more likely that it's omega 1, because the probability, the functional probability says that the probability is higher in this case. Okay? That's not exactly how Bayesian classification works, because if you're only considering these likelihoods, you're not taking into account the a priori probability. Okay? So basically, what I just mentioned, as you compare the likelihoods and select the one that has a larger probability, if you include also the a priori probability, then that becomes the Bayes rule. And the Bayes rule says, in this case, exactly this. The conditional probability of each class, given the sample that I have, is equal to the likelihood of each class times the a priori probability and divided by a common constant factor. This factor simply normalizes the probability so that it has a value between 0 and 1. Okay? And as I said before, the only element that's different here is that I'm considering the appropriate a priori probability. So in this simple example, according to the a priori probability, this would be, in fact, the Bayes rule, what it allows you to compute is the a posteriori probability. So the a posteriori probability is the likelihood times the a priori probability divided by the normalizing constant. And in this example, if you compute the a posteriori probability for class 1 and for class 2, you would have these two functions. Okay? So basically, Bayes rule can be used to answer the question probabilistically. Given a certain value, for example, which class might it belong to? You can see several things here. You can see that the sum of the a posteriori probabilities is always equal to 1. Okay, so when the value is this one, the probability that it's class 1 is 0.1, more or less, and the probability that it is class 2 is 0.9 then. Okay? When they are both equiprobable, then the probability of each one is 0.5. Okay? And you can see that everywhere the sum of the two probabilities, the a posteriori probabilities, is equal to 1. So basically, this allows you to select which is the one that has the largest a posteriori probability. In this example, if the value is up to here, then it would be more a posteriori probable that the class is 2. Between here and here, it's more probable that it's class 1, then again class 2, and then finally from here on, it's again more probable that it's class 1. This is exactly how Bayes' theorem can be used in this context. The system is going to compute the a posteriori probability for each class given the sample, which is X, and then it's going to decide the class that has the largest a posteriori probability. That's all. That's the basic functioning of the Bayes rule. Okay? We can study first, this is what we will do next, how do we define what is the likelihood, and how do we define what is the a priori probability, and once we have that, this system can be programmed in a very simple way. You compute each of the a posteriori probabilities and then select the maximum, as this formula says, and that's the answer of your recognition system to the question, which class does it correspond? Does X correspond to? Okay, so several factors have influence in the decision that this algorithm makes, and it's very simple to see, for example, the influence of the a priori probability. In case the two classes are equally probable without seeing them, then basically the a priori probability has no influence in the result. Because since all of the classes are equally likely, then it's only the comparative likelihood of each that decides which is the correct answer. In this example in the top, then, if the parameter is between minus infinite and this value, then it's more likely that the object is of class 1. And if it's over this value, then it's more likely that it's object in class 2. Okay, so in this case, when all of the a priori probabilities are the same, the system is only based on the likelihood. But it's not always the case, because if it's more probable that a priori you will find class 1, then that makes the decision be different. So if the a priori probability of class 1 is 0.7, for example, the system is going to answer its class 1 up to this value, a little bit to the right than the point where the two values, where the two likelihoods are the same. Why? Because even if the two values here are the same, even if the parameter is this value, the system, as you can say, thinks, well, the likelihoods are the same, but it's more probable that I will see class 1. So in that case, I will still answer class 1. Okay? And if it's much more likely that it's class 1 than class 2, if class 1 is 0.9 and class 2 is just 0.1, then the system is going to keep on responding it's class 1 even up to this value. Okay? So the influence of the a priori probability tells you up to which point the system favors a certain class, because it is more likely that the class appears in the recognition problem. Okay? That would be the influence of the a priori probability. And then you also have the influence of the likelihood itself. So assume that you still have two classes, and this is the likelihood of class 1, and this is the likelihood of class 2. If say that the descriptor tells you the value of that descriptor X is this one. Okay, that is the peak, that is the most probable value for class 1 and also for class 2. But the system is going to answer in all this interval, it is class 1, and this is why. In this simple case, these are two Gaussian distributions. Both have the same mean, but the variance is different. Do you know which one has the largest variance? The black one or the red one? These? The red one? The largest variance? The black one. Okay. The black one has the largest variance. Okay. That means that I can measure that parameter less precisely for class 2 than for class 1. Okay, that's why this system is going to answer class the red class anyway. I'm getting old. Class 2, or the red class for all these values, because Since I can measure that parameter more precisely in the red class, then it's more likely that for these precise values, I'm seeing class 2 instead of class 1. Okay? Even if the appearance of both objects is equiprobable, in case that the likelihood is much more precise for one class, than for the other one, then the system is going to favor that class because it knows that it can measure more precisely that descriptor. That's basically the idea, and that's basically the influence of the likelihood function in the way that the system is going to respond. Is that clear? Okay. So next thing is, how are we going to actually define the likelihood? So we can do this in several ways, and I'm going to teach you three. The first one is the simplest form that the likelihood can have, which is a Gaussian distribution. And this is based in the following analysis. Suppose that I have 15 samples of a certain object, and I measure, this is the area, and I get these values every time that I measure it. I have 15 images. In each one of the images, I've got these values. And if you make a histogram of the values, you will see that it has this distribution. It's more likely that the value is close to 2,000, and it's less likely that it's close to 1,700 or 2,500. Okay? It's not exactly Gaussian, because I have this effect here. Okay, if it were Gaussian, it would be something like this. It's not exactly Gaussian, but maybe it's because the number of samples is too low. Okay, so one simple way to model the likelihood of each of the classes is saying, okay, so I will compute the sample mean of the values of the samples, the sample variance, and I'm going to assume that the distribution of that the likelihood of this object for this particular parameter, which is the area, is a Gaussian distribution. Of course, centered around the sample mean and using the sample variance as the variance. Okay? There's the basic justification that you can use to model this parameter using a Gaussian distribution is the following. If you know nothing else about this parameter, the area, if you only know the mean and you only know the variance, this is the Gaussian distribution is the distribution that assumes less additional information. So knowing nothing else, the best you can do is assume that this distribution is Gaussian. If, of course, you know some other parameter, then it might not be a good idea to assume that distribution is Gaussian. Another good reason for doing this is that the sources of error in measuring the area can be due to different factors that combine in a way that, because of the central limit theorem, say the resulting distribution of error is going to be Gaussian or tends to be a Gaussian if several factors contribute to the actual measurement error. So basically, in many applications of perception, of measurement, we assume Gaussian distributions for this reason, and they work surprisingly well. So the assumptions may not hold in certain cases, but provided, for example, in systems of computer vision, they work extremely well. So this is our first way to model the likelihood of the classes for the parameters that we're going to measure. And as you know, we can compute the sample mean very in a very easy way. We also compute the sample variance in this simple way. So we compute the mean by summing all the values and dividing by n. But we compute the variance, which is the root mean square error. It's the squared differences between the samples and the mean. But it's divided by n minus 1. Do you know why? Why not n? Intuitively, there's a reason which says if I only have one sample, how can I compute the variance? It tends to not make sense. So that would be one justification for needing at least two measurements to be able to compute the variance. The other one is actually theoretical. If you measure the sample variance like this, then this sample variance tends to be the variance of the distribution when n becomes very large. If that's not the case, then if you divide by n, then the sample variance has a bias, a bias. It doesn't tend to the actual variance of the distribution function. So to measure an unbiased sample mean, you divide by n minus 1. Anyway, so we for each of the objects that we learn, we compute for a certain descriptor the mean and the variance. And then what we do is model the object using Gaussian distributions like this. In an application where you're learning the plates of cars, then you could have a situation like this. This would be the parameter area, and this would be the distribution for the area of number 1. The next one is letter J, the next one is number 7. The one that has the largest area is actually letter A. And you can see that it more or less makes sense that the mean area for 1 is the smallest area, and the mean area for A is the largest one. Okay? This is these are different Gaussian distributions that model each of the objects that I should be capable of recognizing, which is 1, J, 7, 4, letter Z, and all the other letters and numbers. So we do this for each of the parameters that we measure. And with these Gaussians, we use them to represent each of the objects. Object 1 will have this Gaussian for area, this Gaussian for perimeter, another Gaussian for each of the moments that we measure. For elongation, we could also use a Gaussian to model the information for number 1. And we do that for each of the objects in the database. So there's some things that you can start to see about how these systems work. For example, there's two. Maybe it's difficult to see, I'm afraid. There's two distributions that are actually very similar in the back, and I think it's. This is 1, J, 7, 4. I think it's Z and U. Why would two distributions of this descriptor be very similar for two different objects? How can this happen? If the objects are very different, how can it happen that the distributions of area are very similar? That's right. The objects are different in other descriptors, but not in area. So the area is very similar for both objects, even though, for example, the perimeter is not. Okay? So that can happen. So what you can see here, for example, is you can answer the following question. Is the area sufficient to distinguish between these objects? No. You can't distinguish easily between Z and U because the area is very similar. You can't easily distinguish between 1 and J because the area is also very similar. You can easily distinguish between 1 and A because the area is very different. Okay? So this, let's say, hints how good is the set of descriptors that you're going to use to distinguish between these objects. So in this case, you can see, obviously, that this descriptor is not enough to distinguish between the objects. If I had... for each of the objects, if I had a completely different, clearly different function, then maybe the area would be enough. Okay? So this is part of the analysis that we have to make. Which and how many are enough and useful descriptors for distinguishing between the objects that the system should be able to recognize? That's something that we will answer in this lesson also. So so this is how we model each of the likelihoods of the objects. And this is one important thing which is not easy to see. This is one important comment relating to which descriptors to use. So in this example, you have two descriptors, descriptor 1 and descriptor 2. And there's, I think, 100 samples of a certain object. Each of the samples is then represented by a point in the XY plane. And you can see then that the mean of the descriptor 1 is right here, the mean of the descriptor 2 is right here, and the amplitude of, or the dispersion of the descriptor 1 is proportional to the variance of the descriptor 1, and also proportional, and in this case proportional to the variance in descriptor 2. You can see some things here. The descriptor 1 is less precise than the descriptor 2. That's why this interval is larger. And but the most important thing that you can see here is that both descriptors are independent statistically. Okay? How do you measure independence? Well, maybe the adequate term would be uncorrelatedness. How do you measure uncorrelatedness? You measure the correlation factor, which has this formulation, and when the two descriptors are uncorrelated, then this correlation factor is 0. Correlation can be between minus 1 and 1. Okay? What does correlation mean? What does correlation tells you? It tells you how dependent one descriptor is on the value of the other. And what you like as a good set of descriptors for recognition is a good set of independent descriptors or uncorrelated. If in this example the samples would be like this, then that would mean that the correlation is negative. Okay? The correlation is positive when the dispersion has this shape. Okay? So what does negative correlation mean? It means that if the object has a high value for descriptor 1, then it tends to have a low value for descriptor 2. So an increase in one descriptor reduces the value of the other. And on the other hand, if the value of descriptor 1 is low, then it tends to have a high value for descriptor 2. So if the descriptors in the, let's say, extreme case, if they are fully correlated exactly minus 1, that means that if you measure 1, you already have the value for the other. So 1, so the second doesn't give you any additional information about the object, because the first one already gave you enough information. Okay? So, as I say, what you want about the descriptors is to have them being independent, so that you can have additional information every time that you measure a new descriptor. This would be an ideal case, and this would be the worst case possible. Also, this would be the worst case possible. Either positively or negatively correlated, you don't want descriptors of that type. Okay? So this is, if we model the likelihoods as Gaussians, this is how the system is going to work. We can use a very simple algorithm, which is an iterative method. And it basically starts by assigning, what we're going to do is compute the a posteriori probability for each of the classes that the system is able to recognize. So what's the initial value for the probability of each class? It's the a priori probability. So in step 0, or in iteration 0, the probability for each class is the a priori probability. And then the system iterates measuring different descriptors. So for example, we start by, in this example, the first thing that we're going to measure is the area. So I measure the area, and with that descriptor, I update the a posteriori probability of class 1, 2, up to n with the measurement of the area. And so I have here This would be descriptor 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. Initially, it would be 1. So what I do is use the likelihood of each of the classes for the value of the area that I computed, and then I compute the a posteriori probability of each class. In this simple example, we all, again have two classes, 1 and 2, and I measure the area, and the result is that the probability of class 1 is around 0.4, and the probability of class 6 is around 0.6. Okay? Again, probabilities, a posteriori probabilities always sum up to 1. So the system is going to decide one of the two classes in this example. The difference is not too large, so the system has to measure another parameter or descriptor. In this case, the second parameter that we measure is the perimeter. We incorporate that information in a second iteration, and the result is that class 1 is slightly less probable than it was, and class 2 is slightly more probable than it was. But it's not a big change still. So I decide to measure another one, which is the maximum radius. That's the largest distance between the perimeter and the centroid of the object, which I also can use to describe objects. So if I measure that maximum radius, actually the probabilities of the objects become close again. Still not a good solution, so I measure another one, which is the minimum radius. And then I start measuring moments, and it's interesting what happens here. First, when I measure the second moment, then the probability or the favored class changes. Then omega 2 becomes less probable than omega 1, which becomes probable close to 0.7, and class 2 close to 0.3. Still not enough. Then I measure the second moment. One of the, these are the 7 invariant moments that I explained in the lesson before. So when I measure the third one, then the system clearly favors omega 1, close to 1, and omega 2, close to 0. If I keep on using more, including more descriptors in the system, then the answer is consistent. It still favors class 1 over class 2. So this is basically the algorithm that we would use for recognition. Start with the a priori probability and then incorporate descriptors as we go along until we see a clear answer. What is a clear answer? Well, it really depends on the system. Anything over 0.9, for example, is clearly a good answer. Okay? So we could, in fact, stop here when we only have measured moment 3, because we already have a clear answer in this case. Okay? So that's the way in which this algorithm works. If you incorporate more classes, then you have to, of course, compute the probability for each of the classes and then see if there's a clear answer at some point, and then stop and say this object is the square, or this object is the circle, or whatever the appropriate answer is. If we do that iteratively, that leads to asking, so which parameters should I measure first? Because if I can answer as fast as I can, the system is going to be more efficient. So maybe there are some parameters that I could measure first because they distinguish better between the objects. Unfortunately, the answer is not always the same. In this artificial example, suppose that I have a circle, a square, and a triangle, and I'm going to use two descriptors, which are the area and the perimeter. If I want then to decide what should I measure first to find out whether it's a circle or a square or a triangle, I could use the area or I could use the perimeter. In this artificial example, I have said, assume that the side of the square is 1, that the radius of the rectangle is 1 divided by the square root of pi, and that the base of the triangle is the square root of 2. In that case, the area of all the three objects is the same, so the area is not going to be a good descriptor for that case, but of course the perimeter is going to be. because in one case it would be 1.77, in the other case it would be 4, and in the third case it would be close to 5. Okay? Of course, I artificially made all the areas be the same, but I can also artificially make all the perimeters be the same so that the answer is the area. So, a priori, you don't know. You can't, let's say, in general, say the best descriptor is this one. But once you have learned the object that the system should be able to recognize, then you can do an analysis which is a little bit more sophisticated than this one. But the basic idea is this one. Once you have all the objects that you know, then you can analyze to see which descriptors are more similar or which descriptors allow you to distinguish better between pairs of objects. And that measure is it's called the J-divergence. So the J-divergence basically compares, as you can see, this is the formulation. It compares the mean value of the descriptor, and it also compares the variances of the descriptor. And it basically allows you to say how similar are two objects, I and J, according to parameter K. Okay, so the J-divergence is measured for a couple of objects and for a certain descriptor, objects IJ and parameter K. In this example, you can see that I have four objects, and I'm using the perimeter. And so these are the likelihoods of each of the objects. And then you can see right here the table of divergence. Could you, just by looking at the graph, tell me which are the two objects that have the highest divergence? Just by looking at the graph. So here you have, let's say you have object 1, 2, 3, and 4. Which two have the highest divergence? Or which two would you expect to have the highest divergence? So divergence tells you how different they are. I'm sorry?
1 and 4.
1 and 4. And which two are more similar? Or less distinguishable? 3 and 4 or 1 and 2? That's difficult to say. What I was saying is, you can predict, if this divergence is useful, you can predict that this one and this one should be the more different. And maybe this one and this one should be the more similar. If you look in the table, then you will find that Circulo Truncado, which is the first one, and Circulo Saliente, which is the last one, actually have the highest divergence, is 220. If you look also in the table, you will see that Circulo and Circulo Truncado have the smallest divergence, okay? Which are the first one and the second, in fact. Okay? So this measurement allows you to compare two objects and say, if you want to answer the question, is it useful to measure this object, this parameter, to distinguish between these two objects? That's what divergence is for. And the way to use it in the recognition is very simple. You compute the a priori probabilities of all the objects, and then you decide to measure one parameter. Okay? And that then tells you, well, it's probable that it's 1 or 2, 0.4 in one case and 0.6 in another one. The way in which you use this divergence is you take the two most probable objects, and then you find out which is the descriptor that allows me to distinguish better between these two. And then you measure exactly that one. Okay? Then you measure it for all of the objects, recompute the probabilities, and then take again the two most probable, find out the descriptor that best distinguishes between those two, and then measure that for all of them. And that's the way in which you decide which is the parameter that I can measure next. This was the result that I showed before, just randomly deciding the parameters. If I actually use the J-divergence, then I'm able to answer in only three parameters which is the object that I'm seeing, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8. Okay? So J-divergence can speed up the recognition by this simple calculation. And it's something that you can pre-compute once you have the database of objects, then you can compute the divergence in pairs, and then you have a table that tells you choose this one or choose this one or choose this one, depending on which two are the classes that are most probable according to the system in a certain moment. Okay? Well, I think this is basically Bayesian recognition. Any questions? Okay, let's make a break. Hi, I haven't seen you before.
Yes, we came today for your lessons.
Okay.
Is there any part of your lessons, will your lessons be in this class, or is there any simulation or computer laboratory?
There's a laboratory, but you have arrived to the university today?
No, we came before, but we came your lesson first today.
Okay, where do you come from?
Turkey.
From?
Turkey.
From Turkey, okay. When did you arrive?
2 weeks ago.
Only 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And why do you come so late in the course?
Because Turkey isn't a member of Europe, so
yes?
There is a visa problem.
Oh, so you had delays mm-hmm. because of the visa? Okay. Because most of the classes are going to be already well into the semester, I'm afraid. So to answer your questions, let's see if the internet is working. You have all the materials of my courses in the web. Let's see. So if you look for me. Oops, not working. Okay, this is my webpage. You have a version in English if it's more adequate for you. And here you have computer vision. Okay? And then you have all the slides. Mm-hmm. And Spanish and English, for example, recognition. This is what we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all the slides are there. And then these are the instructions and programs for the lab. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid we are well into lab 4 now.
Is there any exam or prerequisites?
Is there any?
Exam.
Mm-hmm. No, the exam is, you work on the laboratories, and when the system is finished, I will publish a list, and you have to put your name and say, I will go for the evaluation of the labs on Friday at this time. Mm-hmm. And then you will explain, there's going to be an exam there, you explain how you made the system, how it works, and then we evaluate the course based on those sessions of lab exams. There's not a written exam mm-hmm. in the course. Are you already registered for the course?
Sorry?
Did you register for this course? Because you have to register. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I registered 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Because I haven't seen new people on the list. That's why I'm puzzled. Let's see. Maybe there is somebody new.
Maybe we were late, so...
So did you already talk to people in the international office?
Yeah, we talked to them.
So maybe then she registered you already. Let's see. Vision. No. No new students, I think. It's very important that you register, because then I send the information using email to the students that are registered in the course. So it's important that, that you get the information that I send, of course. I'm sorry? Yeah, no, it's not a big deal. I mean, you can come, of course, and but you need to register to receive my messages. That's basically
we're going to be choose this lesson together with us in international office.
When did you do that?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago? And why didn't you come last week?
Last week? Well, we can't come. Because the lesson is first not choose it.
Oh.
After, we must choose it.
Okay.
Because the other one is Spanish generally courses, so after that, me, you can.
Okay. It's going to be a, difficult for you. You will have to work a lot to be able to, you know, come to the pace that everybody's working with already. But, of course, it's something that you can do. What I suggest then is that you study the slides and work on the labs. Because we have 2 weeks of holidays now.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a good moment for try to maintain the pace.
Okay, after the holidays, we can.
Sure. Okay. So let's see. All these guys are here.